Hello, and welcome to the first episode of The Life of the Mind Brain, a podcast that highlights some of the fascinating research going on in the cognitive sciences and examines how this research relates to, or may someday relate to, broader issues in society. I'm the host, Adam Schreiber. She's out there in the distance. See her through the haze. In the late 90s, Kate Bainbridge had been diagnosed as being in a coma and thought to be completely unable to communicate with the world. However, when researchers, including Cambridge neuroscientist Adrian Owen, measured Bainbridge's brain activation in response to visual stimulation, they found that her brain responded very similarly to that of a healthy individual. Of course, this raised many more questions. Does the brain responding to visual stimuli require that a patient is conscious? Does it suggest that a patient is more likely to recover? Does it change the legal status of the patient or impose new ethical obligations on society? Owen's group began running more tests and refining their technique. Bainbridge eventually recovered from her coma and now frequently sends emails to scientists and journalists about her condition, including this one to New Yorker reporter Jerome Groopman. Quote, "Most scans show what is wrong with your brain, which doctors need to know. But Adrian Owen's scans show what is working. I say they found parts of my brain were working. It really scares me to think what might have happened to me if I had not had the scans. They show people it was worth carrying on, even though my body was unresponsive." Since that time, Adrian Owen has moved from Cambridge to the University of Western Ontario, and his group has refined their techniques and had even more dramatic results. Some patients, who had been diagnosed as being in vegetative states, were found to be able to follow commands in the scanner to do certain things like imagining themselves playing tennis. Some even could correctly answer biographical questions about their lives. And, with the improvement of brain-computer interfaces, we're now approaching a day where patients who were otherwise unable to interact with the world might be able to, for example, remotely move a mouse cursor simply by changing the way they think. In the first two episodes of The Life of the Mind Brain, we'll be taking a deeper look at the history of the research and the questions it raises. In the first episode, I'll speak with Adrian Owen and Damian Cruz about how the research was started, how it has evolved, and what the current approach can do. In episode 2, I'll examine some of the fascinating ethical and legal questions that arise as a result of these findings. I begin with a discussion with Adrian Owen. I am joined right now by Professor Adrian Owen, the Canada Excellence Research Chair in Cognitive Neuroscience and Imaging. Professor Owen, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me.
You're my pleasure.
A very busy guy. I thought for a second it might be best to stake out the London airport to try to get an interview, but seems like we managed to get a good time.
You got me.
So I thought it might be helpful to start out with you explaining a little bit about how you first got involved with working with patients in vegetative states. Did you start out with an idea that there might be issues in how they're diagnosed, or did you get involved working with these patients for other reasons?
Yeah, it was really serendipity, actually. It was 1997, and I had just returned from Montreal, where I had done a three-year postdoc, learning the black art of brain imaging. And one of my colleagues, Professor David Menon, who is now chair of the anesthetic department at the University of Cambridge, suggested that I see a patient who'd recently been admitted to the intensive care unit at Addenbrooke's Hospital in Cambridge, and she was in a vegetative state. And her name was Kate Bainbridge, and I can say that because she's a patient who's been involved in a fair amount of publicity herself. Mm-hmm. But at the time, she seemed to be in a vegetative state and hadn't responded, like all of these patients, for several months since an infection had affected her brain function. And David and I put her into it was a PET scanner in those days, and we put an experiment together, a study together very quickly, a few pictures of her family and friends, just to see whether we could get any activity from her brain. And I think if we hadn't seen anything, I wouldn't be sitting here with you today. Mm. I would have probably thought, well, as everybody expected, that doesn't work. Brain scanning vegetative patients is a waste of time. But actually, Kate's brain lit up exactly the same way that we would have expected a healthy, conscious brain to light up when exposed to pictures of her friends and family.
Wow.
So it was really quite an extraordinary early result. And I think we got very lucky.
Wow. And after you found these results in the scanner, she went on to recover?
Yes. And I suppose in that sense, she was a very unusual patient. Kate, over the next, over the next few years, made a significant recovery. She's still very physically disabled, I would say, but cognitively she's absolutely fine. And I can say that with some confidence because Kate often sends emails to myself and other members of the research team describing her experiences and the experiences that she's had over the nearly 15 years now since that scan. And she's extremely, at least in email, vocal about about the goods and the bads of that period of her life.
Does she actually remember the tasks?
So it's interesting. She can't, at least immediately after she started to recover, she wasn't able to clearly remember the scan. But I think that's not terribly surprising. I mean, she'd clearly been through a lot and had many different types of scans and many different types of medical interventions, so it's perhaps not surprising that she wouldn't remember anything. And now what we know about the science, I think we can say we can't be sure that she was aware either, just because her brain responded to faces.
Sure.
We can say that the parts of her brain that were responsible for perceiving faces were working properly. They were intact, and that it is was a surprise. That doesn't necessarily mean that she was aware. That was really something that came much later.
Right. So just being able to recognize faces doesn't necessarily show that the patient is aware. And over the years, I guess you refined some of the tests that you were doing on patients who had been diagnosed as being vegetative. And then in 2006, you had a really groundbreaking result. Can you describe that?
Yeah, the period between 97, where we first examined Kate, and 2006, when I think we made the next big leap, we showed that some of these vegetative patients, or apparently vegetative patients, could do, if you like, or respond in all sorts of interesting ways in the scanner. One was obviously Kate with faces, and the other thing that we saw very, very frequently was that if we played speech to a patient in the scanner, the areas of their brain that we know process language would often respond. Terribly exciting at the time.
Yeah.
And we got very, really excited about this, that perhaps this means that the patients can understand language, the fact that we're seeing these areas of the brain responding. It turns out that with the benefit of hindsight and many other studies, that's probably not the case. And I point in particular to a study that we published in 2007 with Matt Davis and again with David Menon and his colleagues from the anaesthetic department at Cambridge, where we took a group of healthy participants and we sedated them using the anaesthetic agent propofol. And we showed that these same speech areas of the brain are still responsive in healthy people when they are demonstrably unconscious, when they're heavily sedated. And we haven't ever done the study, but I think the same would probably be true of faces. I think we would probably, our brains probably are able to process the basic information contained in a face, whether you are actually aware, conscious if you like, or not. So a lot of that work, although it was very intriguing and exciting at the time and pointed us in the direction that we took in 2006, I think with what we know now, it's clear that we wouldn't have, we weren't able to conclude that some of those early studies reflected preserved awareness in those patients. 2006, as you've already said, everything really changed. We went off in a completely different direction. And basically, we sat down and we tried to decide, well, what would we have to see for us to be convinced that this patient was aware, was conscious? And really, it came down to the clinical identification or measurement of awareness. And, I'm sure everybody's seen a medical documentary where there's a patient beside the road and the doctor's saying, "Squeeze my hand if you can hear me." Well, what the doctor's looking for in that sort of situation is evidence of command following. Because command following is really the only way you have of knowing that a patient can understand what is being said and can elicit a response, is actually conscious of typically where they are, the situation they're in. And command following is terribly important clinically. So what we did in 2006 is develop a method for detecting command following with fMRI. We asked patients to imagine a scenario. And it turns out that when you imagine some things in the scanner, very similar areas of your brain will respond as if you were actually doing those tasks. And we can use that as an index of command following. The best example we have of that is having people imagine playing a game of tennis. When you ask healthy, conscious people to imagine they are playing a game of tennis, part of their brain with the premotor cortex lights up, and that's a bit of your brain that's involved in initiating action. So even if you don't actually wave your arms around as though you're on the center court at Wimbledon, just thinking about doing that is enough to activate your premotor cortex. It's like the hand squeeze that I was talking about earlier. And, you know, it turned out in 2006 that we could show that a patient who was entirely non-responsive, physically non-responsive, could nevertheless activate her premotor cortex when we asked her to imagine playing tennis. And this was the first time that clear evidence of non-physical command following had been reported in a patient who otherwise appeared to be in a vegetative state. And that was a pretty exciting time for us.
What was the immediate reaction from the scientific community and the public when you came out with these results?
I had, in the week after the paper came out, I had 800 emails from, 800 emails that I wouldn't normally expect from random people around the world, from scientists to what I call armchair scientists, people that sit at home having, you know, interesting thoughts about science, from philosophers and ethicists and all sorts of people. And really, there were really just two types of emails. I got a lot of extremely encouraging and friendly emails from colleagues in the field that said, wow, it's great. It's really great to find that fMRI can do something important, do something interesting. It's an interesting response. It was certainly the first time I'd been involved in a study where imaging had been used to answer a question that really couldn't be answered in any other way, and I think had quite fundamental implications for that patient. So that was quite exciting. The other type of email were people that really objected to the fact that we'd concluded that this patient was conscious. And I think it's interesting because that really mapped out the next few years of my life, which was exploring, well, is it possible that this person couldn't be conscious? And really, the whole series of experiments that followed that, or studies, I should say, that followed that 2006 paper in Science, were really designed just to show that she really must have been conscious. There's no other explanation.
And which of those studies do you think was sort of the strongest case? Or do you think it's a combination of the follow-up studies?
A combination. I mean, one example related to something we've already discussed is what happens when you take healthy participants and give them and sedate them, make them unconscious. Can they still imagine playing tennis? And this is a study that, again, David Menon, my former colleague at Cambridge, has carried out recently with his team and shown that actually you only have to mildly sedate somebody and they can't imagine playing tennis anymore. So that activation that we now are very familiar with in the premotor cortex whenever somebody thinks about imagining playing tennis, that's gone, even when people are just mildly sedated. So, you know, it seems that consciousness is required for you to generate that type of response. But also playing around with the reliability of that effect. And several of our studies have shown that, you know, really somebody has to not only be really really on the ball, no pun intended, but, you know, really thinking about playing tennis. They really do have to be aware that that's what they're doing, and they have to want to do it. One of my favorite studies that I carried out was to show that people can even not imagine playing tennis when they've been told specifically to imagine playing tennis, if they've previously been told to not do what they're asked to do. So we put some people into the scanner saying, we're going to ask you to do things and we want you to not do it. And then in the scanner, they would hear the instruction, please start imagine playing tennis. And nothing happened. And this is really, I think, for thinking about consciousness, this is terribly important. It means that it's not an automatic response. That's what we were trying to address, that some people had said, well, this could be some sort of automatic brain response, that these vegetative patients, they're not conscious, but it just happens in their brain. And it can't just happen in their brain, because we as healthy individuals are completely in control of this. It shows that even if I ask you to imagine playing tennis, you don't have to do it. It's not an automatic response. You have to want to do what I've asked you to do.
So it involves all sorts of things. You have to be able to understand the information. You have to have a desire to carry out the command, and then you have to actually be able to do the command. So it seems like that combination of events makes it pretty unlikely that they're doing this all.
That's absolutely true, and I think that's what a lot of people missed. It, you know, in the format of the original paper, it was a very short and sharp, paper, and I understand that a lot of people missed this. But you're absolutely right. In order for that response to have occurred, she really had to be involved in really quite a lot of different cognitive processes. That there really is no evidence that this could have happened without consciousness.
So that's really fascinating. And then it seems to kind of leave you in a predicament if that was all the information you have, because now you have patients who had previously been diagnosed as being in vegetative states. Now you know that they seem to be able to follow commands, but they're still in a fairly limited state, which raises questions about how are they feeling? Is this a miserable existence to be completely unable to communicate with the world, or are they fine? And I've seen various philosophers speculate from the armchair about how well they're doing or not. But you guys took it a step further and developed even a new task that, at least in some of the patients, can start to even address more questions rather than just are they conscious or not, but actually start getting at some of their desires. Can you say a little more about...
Yeah, I mean, this was really something that actually came about very quickly after the 2006 paper. It just took us a little bit of time to get it going. But, again, many of the emails that I received said, well, that was great, but why didn't you ask her a question and get her to say, play tennis for a yes and do another task for a no? And, of course... Mm-hmm. This is something that we had considered, but I don't think we ever thought things would work quite as well as they actually did. So very soon after that first patient, we did start to try this idea in different patients who had been diagnosed as vegetative. Once we established that they were actually not what they appeared to be, once they were conscious, to ask them questions. And we've worked for many years with Stephen Laurie's team in Liège in Belgium. And in 2010, Stephen's team identified a gentleman who at least had been diagnosed as vegetative over a five-year period. And they were able to take the technique that we'd developed together and ask the patient a series of questions that he could answer using a yes-no. Now, back then, we were... again, we were feeling our way in the dark, to be honest. I mean, I don't think we ever really believed that it would work as well as it did. And there, we stuck with questions that had real-world concrete answers that we could go and check afterwards. These were questions that we didn't know the answers to. That was important, to keep the whole thing blinded, as we say.
Sure.
But it wasn't terribly interesting information about the patient. It was things like, do you have any brothers and sisters? And the patient responded, yes, he did. And we would then check that he was communicating the right answer. So it told us quite a lot about his mental state, I think, but it didn't tell us anything particularly important clinically or therapeutically. That's something that we've developed a lot since I moved here to Western University in Canada. Really, one of the things we're exploring here is how far can you push this idea? Really, can you find out what it's like be in a vegetative state?
Mm-hmm.
We've recently asked a patient whether he's in any pain, for example, which is a question that many people have suggested is perhaps the most important first question you should ask, because it's something we can actually do something about.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's an important one. I think down the line there are other questions that I can imagine people think we should ask to do with what people want to happen, and what decisions should be made about their future. And I think it's inevitable that this work will probably move in that direction, but I think there are many hurdles to be overcome before we can do that.
Has the research changed at all as technology has been developed? Is there anything about your research that's been responsive to the progress and different ways of measuring what's going on in the brain?
Yes, absolutely. When I think back to Kate Bainbridge, the first patient, now this is really before, at least where I was working at the time, in Cambridge, we didn't have an fMRI scanner. We had PET. Now, PET produced many of the same lovely images of brain activity, but it involved radiation. Now, that's not to say a single PET scan is particularly dangerous for anybody, but it does mean that it's something that you can't repeat over and over again. So actually, that study on Kate, even though we only had a very short period to plan it, we really had to think of something that was going to give us some really important information, because we knew that we weren't going to be able to scan her the next day or even perhaps the next week follow it up. There was a limited number of scans that we could do with her, and that was always an important limitation with PET scanning. Now, with the advent of fMRI, where there's no radiation and there's no medical reason why you can't repeat fMRI scans very frequently, this obstacle to progress has really been removed, and many of the most important things that we've discovered in these patients have only been possible because we've been able to scan them on multiple occasions. Because, you know, these patients have good days and bad days like the rest of us. Sometimes we scan them and they're asleep, we can't keep them awake. Sometimes we try and scan them and they're really agitated by being moved around from their hospital bed to the scanner bed, and they move too much and we can't get a good image. Mm-hmm. So actually repeated scanning is really important, and that's something that's only been possible with functional magnetic resonance imaging or fMRI. The other really exciting change in the last few years has been real-time imaging. So even back in 2006, when we first showed that a patient who appeared to be in a vegetative state was actually conscious and aware, we didn't know that on the day. I think many people reading that paper, because it all looks so immediate and all the pretty pictures are there and finished and published, they think we knew it, but we didn't. We scanned the patient. The patient didn't do anything in the scanner because they were non-responsive. But and we spent a few days analysing the data and looking it over and comparing it to healthy participants that we'd scanned before we suddenly realised that this looked exactly the same. The patient must be conscious. But by then, the patient had returned to the hospital they'd come from and was actually hundreds of miles away. So it was really quite exciting a few years later when so-called real-time fMRI came along. And with this sort of technique, we know immediately, within a few minutes, the patient is in the scanner, they're still in the scanner, and we know that they're conscious, which, of course, is how we can go on and do things like ask questions, because we know that it's worth doing. We know that it's worth asking questions because the patient is conscious. And also, another thing we're exploring a lot at the moment that you have to think about, a lot of the questions are dependent on previous answers. If I, when you and I are having a conversation, I'm picking up on something you say to me to give my next answer. It's the same with the patient. If I ask the patient, "Are you in any pain?" and he said yes, well, there's a follow-up question, which is, what sort of pain is it, or where is the pain, or you'd want to know more about the pain.
Right.
And that requires real-time fMRI. I don't want to wait 3 days to have analysed the data and find out the guy's in pain to have to bring him back to the scanner to find out where the pain is. So this does open up many opportunities for what's getting close to real types of conversations. Obviously, it's quite a lot slower and more expensive and cumbersome than real-time conversations, but nevertheless, we're moving in that direction. The third big innovation has been our use of electroencephalography, or EEG, to move in this same direction, because fMRI, it's a spectacular tool. When it works in these patients, it gives us these very clear and beautiful anatomical images. Still, it's non-portable. We have to bring patients to the scanner. Sometimes that involves flying them across Canada. It works. That's okay. We make sure we do all this in as safe and efficient way as possible, but it would be easier if we could go and visit the patient. Mm-hmm. So, my team here at Western have recently developed a more portable and cost-effective technique using electroencephalography or EEG. And the development of that is running a little behind fMRI at the moment. We're really at the stage of being able to detect consciousness where it exists in some of these patients, but we're doing it in a much more cost-effective way at the bedside.
electroencephalography is a little, it's a little harder to get good spatial resolution, right? To locate exactly where, which brain areas are involved. But you guys are sort of using fancy statistics to try to get at.
We are. And it is hard. I mean, one of the, I'm an fMRI guy. That's really what I've been doing for most of the last 20 years. And one of the reasons fMRI is so powerful in this particular context is that you've got so much information about the anatomy. When I put a patient into the scanner and, you know, part of their brain lights up, if you will, it's really important to me that it's the right part of the brain. And I need to know where that part of the brain is to really be absolutely sure that they're doing the task that I asked them to do. And sometimes that's really difficult because a lot of these patients have had very serious brain injuries and their brain, bits of their brain may be missing or bits of their brain may have moved to places they didn't start off being. So it's a difficult job, and having that anatomy, being able to actually see the brain, makes that problem tractable. Mm-hmm. With EEG, even though we do apply, as you say, fancy statistics to try and solve this problem, at the end of the day, we can't really see the brain. We can estimate where we think the signals are coming from, mm-hmm. but it's not quite the same as we're estimating with fMRI as well, but we've got a little bit more control over the anatomy. And, you know, that is something that's been easier with fMRI. On the other hand, EEG has other advantages. We can do many, many more trials with EEG in the same space of time. And I think once we really get the EEG technique working to the same level that we have the fMRI working, I think it will have many benefits in this particular patient population. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And if this works out, are you going to have to change your title to Canada Excellence Research Chair in Electroencephalography, or do you get to keep your...
I don't think so. That's what I employ postdocs for, you see. I think I've got to the stage where my brain is now full, and I can't actually learn another technique. I trained as a neuropsychologist originally, and then I moved into pet activation studies when I moved to Canada to train as a postdoc, and then fMRI came along and I took up fMRI, but I think now it's too late. I don't think I can fit anything else in my head. I have to rely on my super smart team of postdocs to do that.
One member of this team of postdocs is Damien Cruz. Cruz, who made the trip from Cambridge to Western, has been pioneering the use of EEG to study disorders of consciousness. I sat down with Damien to learn a little bit more about the specific techniques he's been using.
Some of the original research was done using fMRI, but you decided to take it in a different direction. Can you explain a little bit about how you got the idea to use EEG rather than fMRI to study some of these patients?
The reasoning behind using EEG was essentially because as good a piece of technology as fMRI is, it's not portable really in any way. If we really want to come up with ways of improving diagnosis and prognostic accuracy that have, you know, a practical impact on patients, we're really going to need something that we can take to the patients wherever they are. It's simply too expensive and often just not possible to bring a patient to an MRI scanner. So what we wanted to do was come up with a way of having a portable means of detecting this level of covert awareness. And so EEG was an obvious possibility.
So fMRI is used, part of the way that they detect awareness is by being able to localize which brain regions are active during different tasks, but that's, as I understand it, quite a bit more difficult with EEG. So how do you go about trying to get around the difficulty with localizing?
fMRI has excellent spatial resolution. It can really tell you quite accurately the regions of the brain which are generating the effect, but its temporal resolution is not very good at all. So in general, you're looking at brain activity which is averaged over a couple of seconds in fMRI, whereas in EEG you get the other side of the coin. So you have very bad spatial resolution, but you get excellent temporal resolution, so you can look at changes in brain activity at like a millisecond level. So the tasks which we employed, which, you know, we also asked people to imagine moving or to attempt moving. And basically because we know the time course of the brain response that we expect, and its kind of characteristics, basically it's what we care about is its frequency content. We know that particular parts of the brain oscillate at particular rhythms when they're performing particular tasks. Mm-hmm. And so we know what that oscillation looks like in a healthy person. And so we look for those oscillations in patients.
What kind of questions are you asking the patients when you're looking for a signal?
You know, what we look for initially is some sign that they can follow a command. So the things which we started out asking them were kind of simple questions like, you know, can you imagine squeezing your right hand into a fist? Or can you imagine wiggling the toes on your feet? We've also tried asking patients to try to move instead of imagining moving, because they recruit very similar brain regions when you're actually performing a movement and when you're imagining it. And so we found that at least in one patient, that works very well as well. And what we're kind of aiming for at the moment is trying other different types of tasks, a task that you can imagine performing, which has a better hit rate, basically. Imagining squeezing your hand is kind of vague, and it's not something that you do very often, probably. Whereas maybe you can ask people to imagine doing something which is much more ecologically valid. It's something that they might be more used to doing. And what that may mean is that the signal is bigger, and therefore we're more likely to identify it.
You mentioned earlier that this technology is more portable. It's the kind of thing where patients don't have to come to you. You can actually bring the EEG recording device into hospital rooms. So has that helped with being able to reach more patients with this technique?
Absolutely. So how we've tried to set it up at the moment is we get a lot of referrals from patients out in the community. And so we try to visit them first. Obviously, you know, we need to get consent and that kind of thing to get them involved in the research. Mm-hmm. But because we've traveled that distance to see them, we can take the EEG with us. And so we can do an initial assessment with the patient there and then on the day, mm-hmm. which is really very useful for us. If it's possible that they can go in the MRI scanner, we'll arrange for them subsequently to come to London and go in the MRI a couple of times over the course of a couple of days. Mm-hmm. And then while they're here for that, we'll do more EEG in between. But we have had several patients who, for whatever reason, can't go in the scanner. So, for instance, if you want to go in an MRI scanner, you have to lie flat and you have to lie still. And an awful lot of patients have problems lying flat. They start to choke and cough and these kinds of things, which means that their head moves a lot, which means your signal is terrible from the MRI.
Yep.
So for several patients, we don't even try the MRI because they would just be too uncomfortable in it. Other patients have metal implants, which might not be compatible with the scanner, obviously, because it's a big magnet, so you don't want to go near it if you have metal implanted in you. So it's certainly, you know, it basically, there's no reason why you couldn't do EEG with a patient, but there's lots of reasons why you couldn't do MRI. So it gives us the possibility of seeing every patient possible.
So one of the most exciting things about this is that it seems like, at least maybe in the future, an EEG would be the type of thing that maybe family members could ask questions themselves and get responses, where fMRI obviously requires going to a facility that has that equipment. Is that something you're working towards, or something that you think is possibly in the near future, or what kinds of steps would be required to get to that point?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So what we've been trying to do is really scale down the equipment that's needed. So when we initially started these studies, you know, we use, state-of-the-art, very expensive cognitive neuroscience kind of EEG tools, mm-hmm. whereas that's kind of overkill potentially. What we can do is scale it down to just four electrodes at the moment, and you can get a really quite good signal from the brain with just four electrodes. And so obviously, you know, four electrodes is much cheaper than 128. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we've reached the point where, at least hardware-wise, it's potentially about as expensive as like an electric wheelchair. And it's the type of thing that you could imagine families may be able to own themselves. There's, you know, a number of hurdles, particularly in terms of the analysis of the signal. Because if you wanted to build a communication device, you'd want, you know, communication has to be kind of very rapid and two-way. Right? Sure. I'd want to be able to ask a question and get an answer really as quickly as possible. I don't want to have to wait an hour and analyze the data offline and then say, oh, the answer to that question was this. So what's required is a lot of very complicated mathematics in order to take the signal in real time and analyze it on the fly and spit out an answer as you go within a few seconds of the brain response. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of, that's our bottleneck at the moment, is finding ways to optimize that, to find the signal which we want to be translating into an output, and being able to get a small laptop computer to analyze it very quickly and give you an answer.
If everything goes perfectly, you know, what kinds of things could you imagine this technology enabling in the future?
This type of technology is already used by some patients who are either completely paralyzed or, you know, have motor function difficulties, in order to drive wheelchairs or answer yes-no kind of questions. And so I see no reason why it can't be applied to the same applications, but for patients in vegetative state, minimally conscious state, these kinds of things. So a lot of the things which I think we take for granted, but a lot of patients, particularly locked-in patients, complain about, is simple things, the very simple kind of everyday issues that they face. So, you know, if you're unable to move and you're a bit uncomfortable and you can't tell anyone about it, then that's obviously not a fun place to be. Providing them with control over the channel that's on the TV, the radio station they're listening to, the lighting, closing the blinds, that kind of thing. It feels like a very small amount of control to give someone over their environment, but actually it makes a huge difference. If you've got the sun in your eyes and you're listening to a song you hate, allowing you to change that is really going to dramatically improve your life.
Thank you so much for joining me.
You're absolutely welcome.
Thanks to Adrian Owen and Damian Cruz for the interview. Thanks to the Rotman Institute of Philosophy for providing space and the sound equipment. The music you were listening to was You Jump First performing Tone Paw, and you may have recognized one of the lead vocalists as Adrian Owen.
Drive Nevada State. She's out there in the distance.
Tune in next week for discussion of some of the interesting neuroethical issues that arise as a result of this research. Until then, this is Adam Schreiber with The Life of the Migraine.
I can smell the oil. But down in the saloon bar are the fruits of the soil. Out in the desert, she is Tonopah. Hat's band is playing one bar too far. Las Vegas is gone, 200 miles to the setting sun. Tonopah.